we can win, but we've got to do some serious organizing. And part of it is we've got to change our media, because the media coverage that took place in Madison was appalling. But it did do one great thing of great value for the people of Wisconsin who were participating, who would then go home and watch the news or pick up the paper, go online and check the coverage. They got a first-class, world-class education in bad journalism and how important it is to have good journalism. And now they're media reformers. Because if you get involved in politics, you learn pretty quickly you have to be a media reformer if you want to win your cause. And that was the lesson we got there.
That's Robert McChesney, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Robert McChesney on the future of journalism and democracy. Remember that old song, Love and Marriage? Goes together like a horse and carriage. You can't have one without the other. It's kind of that way with journalism and democracy. It's long been axiomatic that a feisty and vibrant press is essential to the healthy functioning of democracy. Journalists are the public's eyes and ears as they monitor the activities of the powerful. Their inquiries, investigations, and reporting are vital to what the founders of the country called an informed citizenry. Jefferson and Madison never thought freedom of the press would be the private preserve of a handful of rich media barons such as Rupert Murdoch. The weakening of watchdog journalism is having negative effects on democracy. What can be done to revitalize the Fourth Estate? To talk about these issues is Robert McChesney. He's co-founder of the Free Press and professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's the author of numerous books, including Rich Media, Poor Democracy, The Political Economy of Media, and co-author with John Nichols of The Death and Life of American Journalism. Robert McChesney spoke at the Arlington Street Church in Boston at an event organized by the Action Coalition for Media Education.
We're in an extraordinarily deep crisis of journalism, an existential crisis, and it's a crisis that very much threatens the ability of our governing system to work at all effectively. As flawed as it is, this will look like a golden age in 10 years at the way we're going right now. And let me put it in, there's a study that came out about a year ago at this time that really captured what's going on with American news media. Because what we're seeing right now is the corporate news media, for the most part, have decided they can't make money doing journalism. They're jumping ship. That's what's taking place. And I'll give you a study that explains what's going on, why we're seeing the end of journalism as we know it in this country. The Pew Center, which is a mainstream group funded by the Pew Foundation, the Pew family, does a lot of research on journalism in the United States. And they did a major study of Baltimore, Maryland, in the fall of 2009 for 1 week. They went into Baltimore and they said, we want to see what the news ecology is in this major American city. It's pretty much representative of a major American city. It's blue collar, it's got universities, it's got the standard mix of what you expect in an American city of a million and a half people. And they wanted to look at all the news for a week and say, where's the news coming from? Who's doing it? Now, how much is the internet filling the gap? And they looked at original news stories, not just sort of repeating what someone else did, but where someone actually did something original in journalism. And they found out, to a lot of people's surprise, that 96% of the original news stories in Baltimore, Maryland in that week of 2009 came from old media. New media only produced 4%. And I think people were surprised that new media weren't doing much more, although they shouldn't necessarily have been surprised. But that was, before you get out the champagne corks at the Baltimore Sun newspaper. The other information in the study was rather depressing. The first thing that the Pew Center found out was that, because they've been doing this every year or every 5 years for the last 25 years in Baltimore, is that there were 30% fewer news stories in 2009, original news stories, in Baltimore than there had been in 2001. And more striking, there had been a 73% decline in the number of original news stories in Baltimore from 1991 to 2009. And pretty much this is what we've found everywhere John and I've gone on our book tour, all the research we've done for our book. We've probably gone to 20 cities in the last year, major cities, including Boston a year ago. And we usually go to major journalism schools or newspapers to the newsrooms in every city. And pretty much everywhere we go, the reporters or the professors say it's been about a 50% decline in the number of working reporters here from, say, the mid-'80s or late 80s. There's about half as many as there used to be. So that's pretty much standard everywhere we've gone. It varies in some cities, but that's pretty much it. So we're seeing just a sharp drop-off in reporters, in coverage. State houses have far fewer reporters covering them than ever before. County governments barely covered at all anymore. There's just whole branches of governance in this country that have strong links to private commercial interests. They're just uncovered now completely. That's the good news. It gets worse by the Pew Center study. What else did the Pew Center study find out? Well, they wanted to look at the source of a news story. Where does the news come from? Because it's critical media. One of the first things you learn in media education and media literacy when you see a news story is that why is that story in the paper? Why are they taking that perspective? What are the sources for the story? Why does that story exist? And what the Pew Center did is it looked at all the original news stories, and it found out that 86% of the original news stories came either from a press release or came from an official source saying something that was reported. That was an original news story. The mayor said today, or the governor said today. And what the Pew Center found out was of those 86% stories, the vast majority of them, there was no reporting at all. They simply repeated what a press release said with no intervention, no calling to check the facts, just here's the press release, and that's our original news story. Only 14% of the stories were done by reporters going out and making a story. Say, I'm going to cover this and find out what happened and report it. 86% PR, official sources, 14% actual reporting. Now, to put this in context, a generation ago, there was a lot of PR information and official sources in our news media. That's not a new thing, but the ratio is much more like 40-60 or 50-50, not 86-14. That's an enormous difference. And of that 40% or 50% of the stories that were based on public relations, press releases, and the like, there actually was reporting done. They would call up and check out the facts. They would get another opinion on it. They just wouldn't run verbatim the press release. And there's a lot of data to support this. Some of the research we did for our book is we wanted to look at the number of PR people there are in America working, getting paid to do public relations, compared to the number of working journalists. We think that's sort of an interesting ratio. The number of people trying to doctor the news surreptitiously, so you think it's a legitimate news story, but you don't know that they've actually planted it, versus the number of people supposed to cover the news out in the open so you know what's going on. In 1960, that ratio was 0.75, three quarters of one PR person for every one working journalist. 0.75 to one, 1960. 1980, the ratio was two PR people for every one working journalist. So we went from 0.75 to two in 20 years. Today, the ratio is four PR people for every working journalist, 4-to-1 ratio. And at current rates, it's going to be 6-to-1 in 2 years with the growth of PR and the decline of working journalists. In this environment, what else could you expect but nothing but propaganda? And that's what we have. And that's really sort of, that's where we're at. And that's where we're looking for journalism. So the immediate question when you hear that is, well, what caused that? Why do we have this deplorable situation? Why is it no longer profitable for corporate and commercial news media to do journalism? Why are they jumping ship? Why are they lowering the number of workers and no longer taking it seriously? The conventional wisdom says, well, the internet's responsible. The internet is taking away advertising. The internet's taking away young people, and everybody's gone online now. So the traditional newspapers, radio and TV news, no longer have the commercial support they're used to. And as a result, they can't make any money. The problem with that argument is that it doesn't account for the fact that a lion's share of this began long before Google ever existed, began long before Yahoo or Facebook or Twitter. The peak of employment for journalists in this country was in the mid to late 1980s on a per capita basis. It's been falling since then. Anyone who studied news media in the 1990s know that even though those companies were making record profits throughout that decade, they were closing down bureaus, they were laying off reporters, they were doing whatever they could to make as much money in the here and now, and laying off reporters was one of the key ways. So what the internet really did is it aggravated a situation that was already taking place. And I think a key factor that's been overlooked is that what we saw starting in the 1970s was an enormous amount of concentration of media ownership. And you had fewer and fewer companies with much less competition. And these huge empires, we have less competition. Well, the first thing you do is cut off workers. You know, that's just red ink to you, and you still keep the same amount of black ink. And so they were gutting the system long before Google came along. But however you look at it, the system is now at a point of teetering on total collapse, and it's already collapsed a good bit of the way. Ironically, the same people who blame the internet for destroying journalism as we know it say, well, the internet will also solve the problem for us. You know, it's going to be the solution. It's the cause and the solution simultaneously. All we have to do is sit back, relax, and people will come up with new ways to find a way to support themselves doing journalism online. And the evidence is now in on that idea. It's not happening. That one's not going to happen. Not at all. In fact, we might be further from shore today than we were a year ago. We're not getting closer to that port. We're getting farther from that port. In fact, what we're finding is, as traditional news media go under, and traditional media stop having resources, then they fire their digital reporters too, because they're being bankrolled by the traditional media. Now, at this point, Americans tend to throw, and I apologize to our Canadian friends, this is a quasi-ethnocentric talk I'm about to give. At this point, Americans throw their hands in the air and say, well, I guess it's hopeless. If corporations can't make money doing journalism, I guess we can't have journalism. We just have to throw in the towel and call up Queen Elizabeth and ask her if she's got any relatives who want to take over our country, since we can't have, you know, democracy anymore since we don't have any journalism. That's certainly what we're left. You know, we have this fantasy that journalism is a business, pure and simple, and if you can't make money at it, then you can't have it. And that's the way it's got to be. That's what our founders wanted. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. Instead, what we should understand, and the message that I would bring to you tonight, and you should take from this talk, is that the crisis in journalism, the collapse of journalism in the United States, is a very solvable problem. It's a very easy problem to solve. We just have to open our eyes to our own history and to the history, and to the experience of other democratic nations in the world. And let me explain. What we have to understand is journalism is not a commercial undertaking. Journalism should be understood as a public good. And what I mean by public good is it's something society desperately needs, but the market can't produce in sufficient quality or quantity. And the classic examples of public goods that are used in textbooks and economics textbooks are things like defense spending, military spending. They figured out a long time ago you have governments handle all national defense. That's the only way it works. Everyone's covered. Everyone pays for it. It's not a marketable enterprise. You leave it to markets, you don't have a country. Same thing with public education. If you leave public education to the market, which actually this might be a test in our new Dickens era we're entering, we might find out the answer to this, you leave public education to the market and you'll probably have a system where a significant percent of the population will not be educated at all because there's no money to be made in educating working class kids or poor kids. It's a public good. That's one of the great revolutions of this country in the 19th century was understanding education as a public good. Basic research is a public good. Corporations would be glad to do research to get you from the one-yard line into the end zone where they can cash in some chips, but they have no incentive at all to get you from the 50-yard line to the one-yard line. That's why basic research is done at public universities, and you'd only do it through public support. There's no reason corporations will never support it. If we didn't have basic research as a public good, we wouldn't have things like the internet. The internet is a result of 40 years of public good expenditure by the government. AT&T was offered the internet in the mid-70s, the story goes. The government said, we're tired of paying for this darn thing. You guys want to take it? AT&T studied it and said, we can't make any money off it. You keep it. That's the story in the 70s. So the internet is a result of basic research as a public good. Public good is a very important concept, and journalism should be understood first and foremost as a public good. Another reason why you should understand journalism as a public good, and this is a very crucial point, is that public goods are something you can't, as a citizen, use the market to express your desire for them. It's not something, as a citizen, I can say, I want this, I'm going to vote in the marketplace by buying something so I can get it. Here's an example I would give. I promised you, I make a holy vow, that I will never go to a national park again in my life. If I do, it'll be purely by accident. I have no intention of ever going to one again. And the reason simply is I've been to several. I like them. They're great. But I'm 58 years old, and my remaining years, when I have some free time, there's other stuff I'd rather do than go sit in a national park. It just doesn't, not going to do it for me. Now, according to traditional economic calculus, you know, by people going through their Milton Friedman textbook, they would say, well, Bob McChesney clearly doesn't like national parks. He's not visiting them. He's not going to them. He wants to pave them over, sell them off, turn them into parking lots, just lower his taxes. That's what Bob McChesney wants. That's what my market behavior says that. But in fact, that's the exact opposite. I'm more willing to pay more taxes to have national parks because I understand having national parks is a good thing. It's a very healthy thing, and I'm willing to pay for it. And it's not just about whether I go to it. The world's not just about me. We're complex people. We can want things even if we aren't going to consume them ourselves. We understand that. And that's what public goods are all about. And journalism's a public good. Now, how come no one, until Bob McChesney came up with this brilliant theory, thought of it as a public good? Well, the reason is, for the last 125 years, the existence of advertising has given us the deception, the illusion, that journalism could be a commercially solvent enterprise, that the market would produce sufficient quantity, if not quality, of journalism. Because advertising has provided, since the late 19th century, anywhere from 50 to 100% of all the revenues for our news media. No major news medium received less than 50% of its money from advertising. And that's the catch. That advertising was only there for opportunistic reasons. Businesses advertised because they wanted to sell their product. They had no concern about journalism per se. If they found another way to accomplish their commercial ends, they would do that. But journalism was the best way they could do it. And now advertising's jumping ship. They found better ways to use their funds to accomplish their commercial ends. And journalism is now withering down to less advertising support. In 2010, for the first time in its history, the New York Times got less money from advertising than it did from other sources, under 50%. And those of you who know your newspaper economic history know that 20 or 30 years ago, the New York Times got, like most daily newspapers, 65, 70, 75% of its revenues from advertising. Now it's under 50. It's going away. It's not coming back. Advertisers have no concern about journalism per se. Why should they? And the truth of the matter is that final readers, viewers, purchasers of journalism have never provided enough money in our country's history or any country's history to give us a full throttle journalism a democratic society needs, ever. It's never been. It never has been. It never will be. It's a public good. It never will be marketly solvable. Advertising deceived us into thinking it was. Advertising's gone. Now journalism's standing naked in the market and it's shivering. What are we going to do? At this point, my smartest students say, okay, Mr. Smarty Pants Professor, if advertising deceived us into making a thing it's not a public good for the last 125 years, how do you account for the fact that for the first 100 years of American history, before there was that much advertising, we had the most dynamic press system in the world? We had probably 10 times the number of newspapers per capita of any other country, Britain, France, or Canada, in the first half of the 19th century. And there was very little advertising in those papers. How do you explain that? It's a good question. I think we all should ask that. And that's why we wrote this book. Because what we did is we did a lot of research into the first 100 years of American journalism and the First Amendment to answer that exact question. And that's what is really the key to solving the problem. And what we discovered was if you look at the founding of this country, the Constitution and the creation of the Republic in the first 100 years of American history, there were two core principles of freedom of the press in the United States at the beginning of this country and for the first several generations. We know one of them today. We all know it. It's the one we think is the only core principle, and that is the government shouldn't censor media, shouldn't censor journalists. We all agree with that. We think that's the be-all, end-all of the First Amendment, but it isn't. There's a second core component of the First Amendment, freedom of the press, that our founders understood and wrote about and internalized. It wasn't even debated, any more than they debated the censorship thing. It wasn't debated that much. It was just understood and internalized. Which was the first duty of the democratic state is to make sure you actually have a press system, that you actually have a fourth estate. If you don't have a viable fourth estate, the right to not have it censored doesn't mean anything. You've got to actually have a press system in place that's independent before you worry about whether you censor it or not. And no one in the beginning of this republic thought the market would deliver the goods. That wasn't even thinkable for the first 100 years of American history. Oh, we'll just leave it to the market. Well, the entrepreneurs will figure that one out. We'll get our free press from them. No one said that. No one. Nada. So where did it come from? And this is the interesting part of the story. It came from extraordinarily large public subsidies. Off the charts, huge public subsidies created the press system in this country, primarily through the post office, but also through printing federal and state printing subsidies from the State Department, from Congress, and the White House. And to give some sense, before I go into these subsidies, I think it's worth backing up, because part of the research that John and I did for the book is we went back and we reread, or for the first time read, a lot of Jefferson and Madison's work, especially because they were the two framers who talked the most about press issues, to understand why they were so obsessed with press, other than the obvious sort of almost cliche that you need to know what's going on, and the press gives people the information they need to have self-government work. But they were actually, in both the case of Jefferson and Madison, they both wrote specifically about the core reasons from their understanding why the press thing was central to everything. In Jefferson's case, in his most famous essay in 1787, he wrote about, someone asked him, why do we need this freedom of the press thing, Jefferson? What's that all about? And Jefferson said, well, it's very simple. Look at Europe. In Europe, basically, you have the societies divided between the wolves and the lambs, and the wolves are devouring the lambs. And for those of you who aren't good for allegory, he said the wolves are the rich and the lambs are everyone else. And we will have the exact same thing here unless we have a credible press system. Because the only thing that prevents inequality, the only thing that can prevent inequality and make our system work is if people without property have access to the same information as people with property. People with property will always get the information they need to run society. That's never a concern. But people without property, that's the concern. People who are poor, that's the concern. They cannot participate unless they have access to the information they need equal to the access given to the wealthy and powerful, the property owners. That was Thomas Jefferson in 1787. Madison took it up a notch. Madison, especially late in his life, when he wrote pensively after he left the White House, Madison was a classical scholar, as were most of the framers. He knew Greek and Latin. He studied ancient Greece. He studied the Roman Republic. And he knew that the decline of the Roman Republic and classical Athens had been when those democracies had become formal empires. And basically, there was a conflict between being an empire, a militaristic state, and being a democracy. Something had to give. And in Greece and in Rome, what gave was the republic or democracy. They became full-throttled empires. And so Madison was obsessed with not letting the United States become a military empire. That was one of the core things. As George Mason said, one of the other framers, said, when we wrote the Constitution, the idea was to make it really hard to go to war. We don't want to make it easy to go to war. The idea is to make it extremely difficult, put lots of barriers in front of the government before it can take us off to foreign war. And Madison's most famous quote on this was, a country cannot remain free if it is simultaneously at permanent war abroad. So there will be corruption, there will be inequality, there will be secrecy. All the things that come with empire are antithetical to democracy and to self-government. And in Madison's view, the only thing that would prevent the United States from becoming an empire would be a credible press system that would keep an eye on people in power. Because as in Athens, as in Rome, would be the same in the United States. No matter how benevolent our elected leaders are, when you're sitting on top of the richest country in the world, and even in 1790, it didn't take a genius to see where this country was going. If you're sitting on top of the richest country in the world, even the most benevolent elected leader is going to get imperial ambitions. It just goes with the territory. It happened in Greece, it happened in Rome, it happened in Britain, it would happen here. And the only thing that would prevent that, and therefore the destruction of the empire, or the republic to an empire, would be a press system that would monitor government and make it very difficult, if not impossible, to go to permanent foreign war. What's interesting about Jefferson and Madison's point, I think if you look at our news media and our society today, in retrospect, you know, I would give them sort of an A+ in sort of the Nostradamus scale. These guys sort of nailed it, if you think about it. You look at the two core great crises of our society, grotesque inequality, a collapsing public sector as a result, and an empire with all the things that come with it, secrecy, corruption, that's right there. That's the problem we have, and they hit it in the head. And that's why they were obsessed with creating a free press and not just leaving it to the market, leaving it to rich merchants to produce the journalism for each other, but instead to have a democratic press. And they did it through extraordinary subsidies, the most important of which is the postal subsidy. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the history of the American Post Office. It's certainly fair enough if you know nothing about it. It's been a source of ridicule for the last generation. Jokes is sort of a silly sort of place. It's nothing of the kind. It's a truly great democratic institution. It's America's great tangible contribution to democracy in the world was the post office. The post office was by far the largest branch of the federal government for the first 100 years, 125 years of American history. 80% of all federal employees in the 19th century were postal workers. And the post office was, first and foremost, what it delivered was newspapers. 95% of the weighted traffic of the post office in the 19th century was newspapers. 70% of the individual units were newspapers. The post office was the distribution circulation department for all American newspapers until the 1820s, and all weekly newspapers deep into the 20th century. That's how they distributed all their papers. Sort of non-postal delivery of newspapers only began in the largest cities in the 1830s, where it was sold independent of the post office. Otherwise, it was mailed. Post office used to go out two or three times a day in large cities in that period. So what the post office charged to mail a newspaper was going to determine how many newspapers you had. It was an absolutely foundational issue, what they were going to charge post newspapers to be mailed, how many newspapers would exist. Now, today, of course, if we listen to Glenn Beck's rendition of Tom Paine, we would expect that they would have been waving copies of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations and demanding these newspapers pay full freight, no free lunch, no free ride, no corporate welfare, no subsidies, newspapers pay full freight. Instead, what we find, if you look at the debate starting in 1792 on the floor of the House on what to charge newspapers, debate went something like this, because the Constitution required Congress to set up the post office. At one extreme position were those who argued that newspapers should be very, very heavily subsidized compared to normal mail, and the government should chip in money to subsidize the mailing of newspapers. So if a first-class letter costs 24 cents to mail, a newspaper would cost 1 or 2 cents. Even though a first-class letter could be very small and a newspaper could be very fat, didn't matter. 1 or 2 cents to 24 cents, a huge subsidy to encourage newspapers. That was one extreme position. The other extreme position, supported and endorsed by no less than President Washington at the time, who, interestingly enough, was considering making Tom Paine the first Postmaster General at Jefferson's urging. The other position, the position of James Madison, was that all newspapers at all times should always be sent for free anywhere in the country. Any charge for postage, Madison said, would be a form of censorship, because the first ideas, the first newspapers that would go out of business would be the most marginal dissident newspapers, the ones that most out there would be the first ones to go under. And Madison was a person from the Enlightenment. He said, those are exactly the viewpoints we need, because in the Enlightenment view, that's where the truth came from. The truth never came from the powerful. That's where the lies came from. So you had to encourage keeping those viewpoints open with a subsidy. That's an investment in democracy. That was Madison's position.
You're listening to Robert McChesney, The Future of Journalism and Democracy. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
They were extremely heavily subsidized. But to give some sense, I said 95% of the weighted traffic, 70% of the individual units were newspapers in the 19th century. Only 10% of the revenues of the post office came from newspapers. Only 10% of the revenues. There were also huge printing subsidies. I won't go into those, but I will tell you this, that as part of our research, because we were so astounded when we looked at the original data on this, there actually were the post office did studies to figure out how much it was costing them to send all these newspapers everywhere. We went back and we looked at the original data and we tried to figure out what would the U.S. government have to spend today if it, as a percentage of GDP, if the federal government subsidized journalism today to the same extent it did in the 1840s, where we have hard data for both the printing and postal subsidies. And the figure is $35 billion. $35 billion. Now, just to keep this into context, we're currently spending $420 million total federally on public and community radio and television. $35 billion is what we'd spend if we were spending in those rates of the 19th century. I urge you all, if you haven't read Tocqueville's Democracy in America, or if you read it and didn't know this, go back and reread. There's like 10 pages he writes about newspapers in it. And he's flummoxed in it. He's going, first he says, the post office is amazing in this country. It connects all of America, all the way from the Atlantic to the Mississippi, is more connected, thanks to the post office, than a single province in France. That's how brilliant this post office is they have in America. And he said, there are newspapers everywhere. You can publish a newspaper, even if you only have a couple hundred people reading it. It's incredible. He couldn't understand the economics of it. How do they do this? How do you have a newspaper with 200 readers and you can stay in business? Well, it's because of the postal subsidy and the printing subsidies that kept them going. And the genius of these subsidies was that there weren't, no one in the government said, well, you get it and you don't. You know, no one was cherry picking. The abolitionist press got it and the slave owning press got it. Everyone was eligible. There was no cherry picking. That didn't become an issue until World War I. We went a long time before the post office got in the game of cherry-picking winners and losers. And then one other point on this, because it's a great part of our history, and being in a UU church with a great abolitionist tradition, it's worth noting this. There was one group of newspapers in the 19th century that got completely free postage for their mailing, only one group, in the late 1840s. And today, being the cynics we are, understandably are, about government, we would assume that what happened, no doubt, was that Horace Greeley and the big publishers in New York and Philadelphia rented a couple fancy train cars, loaded it with bourbon and greenbacks and painted women, headed down to Washington and bought off the politicians and got a cushy deal for their newspapers, free postage. That's the American way today, we're told. But it wasn't the American way then. What happened in the late 1840s was the first and only group ever to get completely free postage were the weakest newspapers in our entire system. The least politically powerful, the least connected. There were weekly newspapers got free postage in their own little home county. That was it. Free postage. The most flimsy, marginal newspapers. And guess what type of newspaper constituted that group more than any other? The abolitionist press. And that was one of their main campaigns, because the entire abolitionist movement, and churches like this it was coming out of, was based on newspapers. That's what it was in the North. It was a newspaper movement. They fought for that subsidy because their movement needed it. The papers wouldn't have survived without it. You couldn't survive with 200 readers unless you had free postage, even in your own county. So that's something we should be very proud of. Most nation states in the world in the 19th century, in Europe, primarily were just armies. They were just police forces. They collected tariffs. They were bad guys to the people of the country. That's why there's government evil thing that runs through Western theory. Our national state was different because we had this post office. We had this enormous subsidy in making democracy happen and making a free press happen. And it's really our tangible great contribution to the world. It's one we've forgotten, but interestingly, as I'm about to tell you, the world learned after we forgot it. And that's the other good news. Oftentimes at this point, people go, okay, professor, you know, that was back in the 19th century. That wasn't the real America. I mean, the founding fathers, let's face it, those guys were weird. They were almost French. You know, these guys, you know, they didn't have football, they didn't have shopping centers, they didn't have electric guitars, they didn't have pizza. They had nothing that real America is all about. So maybe the Supreme Court, when it considers freedom of the press issues, says we got to take a mulligan on the 19th century. And there's really freedom of the press starts in the 20th century when corporations kick into gear and they own the news media. And the First Amendment now is to protect their right to do whatever the heck they want. That's the meaning of the First Amendment. Because let's be honest, the Supreme Court tends to frame its interpretation of law given the environment it's in. It changes it given the political winds. And maybe the Supreme Court said we got to rethink the First Amendment in lieu of the fact that now it's run, news media is run by big corporations making money, and that's got to be the new sacrosanct right. So as part of our research, we went back and reread the 7 or 8 major Supreme Court decisions on the First Amendment in the 20th century, and there have only been 7 or 8 that consider the relationship of the press system to the government. And we reread them, and I'd read them all in graduate school 30 years ago, and to put it mildly, it's astonishing to reread them. The words that I didn't even pay much attention to in 1985 jumped off the page at me. There's a couple of great decisions for those of you who are really interested in this. The AP versus United States decision in 1945 has a majority opinion by Hugo Black that's one of the most brilliant statements of freedom of the press ever written. The 1971 Pentagon Papers case, Hugo Black again and Potter Stewart, two extraordinary statements. And what they said in these statements was, in effect, that it's the duty of the government to make sure you have an independent fourth estate. It's not an option, it's a duty, it's a requirement. The entire constitutional system depends on it. If there isn't a viable, credible, independent news media, fourth estate, nothing works. We lose our freedoms, the whole system collapses, corruption takes over. It's not an option, it's a duty on a free people to do that. That's what they say. And for those who didn't read the law opinions, Potter Stewart in 1974 wrote an article in the Yale Law Journal. And I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but he said, in effect, the Free Press Clause of the First Amendment is a structural requirement on the U.S. government to create a press system. A structural requirement. Because without it, you can't have the governing system work. It's the only way you can keep tabs on people in power. And in Stewart's 1971 Pentagon Papers opinion, he basically channeled James Madison. It was just exactly what James Madison written about empire and press. It was what Potter Stewart wrote in 1971 in the Pentagon Papers case. So the Supreme Court, if we take it seriously, if we're going to be a strict constructionist and take what the court has said repeatedly in every decision, including recent decisions, doesn't just give us the right to intervene in our press system, it requires it of us. Not the right to do subsidies, since the markets failed, but the obligation to do subsidies. And the logic, in my view, is obviously we have to have massive public subsidies to create independent, uncensored, competitive newsrooms, largely nonprofit and non-commercial. And that's the only way we're going to have a credible press system that's going to work in this country going forward. That's the obvious conclusion I think the evidence points to. I see no other conclusion that works. Let's look at all the other major advanced democratic nations in the world that have similar economies to ours and that have democratic systems, not dictatorships, but countries that might have more in common with us, and see what they're doing. Maybe we learn more from Canada, Britain, Germany, and Sweden than we do from Uganda and Pol Pot's Cambodia. Maybe that's a more relevant pool of comparison for us if we want to figure out our way out of this problem. And what do we learn then? This is what we learn. We learn, for example, if the United States spent, the federal government of the United States spent, or any of all levels of government in the United States spent to support just public broadcasting per capita, the same level as Canada, New Zealand, or Australia, and this is the low end, we'd have to spend on a per capita basis instead of what we're currently spending, the $420 million federally, and billion if you include all the states and universities and all that, we'd have to spend between $7 and $10 billion annually, not $1 billion. If we were to ramp it up to the next level, and we were to support public and community radio and television to the same level of, say, Japan and Britain, then we'd be looking more at the $20 billion a year rate. That's what our federal budget would be, or our government budget, $20 billion, as opposed to what it is, $1 billion, even less. And then if you want to take it to the top level, Germany, Sweden, Iceland, Finland, Norway, Denmark, then we're looking at $35 billion a year. That's what they spend per capita. We'd have to spend, if we had the same per capita rate as them, in federal subsidies, government subsidies of journalism, $35 billion. Remember that number 35? You heard that before, didn't you? Ding! That seems to be the democracy level. If you're going to invest in a credible democracy, that's the sort of amount you spend, $35 billion. That's what we used to do, and that's what these countries do. But wait a second. We have to be skeptics here. How do we know that money's being worked effectively? How do we know those countries are really democracies? So what we did is we looked at a couple of measurements. One was called The Economist magazine. I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. It's a British weekly news magazine, very pro-business. It's The Economist. Loves Ronald Reagan, loves Margaret Thatcher, loves free markets. It's also libertarian and social issues, and it does some very good reporting at times as well. But every year they rank all the countries of the world in what they call their democracy index. They've been doing it for a long time. You can go online, just do The Economist Democracy Index. And they rank them from top to bottom, most democratic nation in the world to least democratic. And the least democratic is invariably North Korea, any communist countries down at the bottom. And they use traditional political science criteria for who are the most democratic and who are the, you know, ease of vote, lack of corruption, ability to start parties, civil liberties, anything political science to really say this is what a good democratic society would have. And what's interesting, the United States in last year's, their most recent ranking in the Democracy Index, The Economist put the United States 17th, 17th in the world. And guess who the first four countries in the world are? Just take a wild guess. I wouldn't mention it, obviously, if it wasn't who you think it's going to be. Denmark, Norway, Finland, Sweden, the countries with the highest per capita press subsidies in the world are the most democratic countries, according to The Economist magazine, the most democratic countries in the world. Now, they don't talk about free press exactly there, so maybe that's not good enough evidence. So what I did is I went to another group you might have heard of called Freedom House. Freedom House is a group that was started in the Cold War to monitor the freedom of people around the world, and they're especially monitoring freedom in left-wing governments and communist countries, and they're particularly concerned with communist countries' harassment of individual civil liberties and private press system, censorship of media. And every year, Freedom House, which is based in Washington and has a very close relationship with Langley, as well as the State Department, Freedom House ranks all the countries in the world on how free their press systems are. And they have a number of criteria. It's actually a very sophisticated system. It's not just government harassment of private media. But they rank all the countries, and they're either free press, a semi-free press, or an unfree, not free press. And the not free press is always every communist country in the world's tied for last because they don't have any private media. So they're just unfree. They're hell holes. But they have very sensitive antennae, again, for any government harassment of private media. So Venezuela, which has a thriving private media which is extraordinarily critical of the sitting government and gets a lot of attention in the country and not very much censorship, ranks as an unfree press, according to Freedom House, because they've been threatened by the government enough that it's a chilling environment, according to Freedom House. So they rank right down there with Cuba as the only country in the Western Hemisphere that has an unfree press, is Venezuela, along with Cuba, according to Freedom House. So these guys are not left-wingers. I just want to get the picture where they're coming from. So Freedom House, they rank all the countries. Well, guess who their most free presses in the world are? Top five, the heaviest press-subsidizing countries in the world. U.S. is ranked 24th in the world, according to Freedom House, as free press system, because of for a variety of reasons, including the fact our sources are, it's hard to get access to sources, and there's so much secret information in this country. So, but Freedom House says it's the freest press systems in the world. The private press systems, commercial press systems, are in the countries with the largest public subsidies of journalism. So I think that the evidence is pretty much clear. You can easily have huge press subsidies that not only promote democracy, but also make it possible to have a private independent news media that prospers with less censorship and more credibility and does better. In fact, the research now that's come out, and it's conclusive in Europe, is that as they've increased subsidies for journalism in Norway and in Sweden and in Finland and in France, it's increased the opposition to the government. It hasn't created a more quiescent, lackey press. It's had the opposite effect. Because the subsidies are set up to encourage the second, third, and fourth papers in a town to survive, not just have one newspaper in a community. So it creates more diversity. And the reason I go through all this is not that we should imitate those countries, but this is a very solvable problem. That's my point. Other countries are all doing it. They figured out ways. They're struggling. They don't have perfect answers. They're going through the same stuff we're going through with their commercial media. But at least they're sort of got it pointed in the right direction like we once were. It's the direction we have to go if we're going to solve this problem. There's just no other way around it. Now, at this point, again, in my talks, what tends to happen, I open it up to questions. And the first question is, are you insane? Do you honestly think you could ever do anything like that in America? How crazy are you, Professor? What is going on with you? And, you know, I think that that's an understandable response. And I take it seriously, although I'm an optimist, as you can probably tell. Maybe you can't, but I am. I wouldn't be doing this if I wasn't. I'm an inveterate optimist, and I think it's grounded in good reasons. But understand this. In the last 2 years, there's been such a sea change that even people who normally wouldn't notice it are noticing it. We have major studies being done right now at the Federal Communications Commission and the Federal Trade Commission on the collapse of journalism, with the idea to come up with policy recommendations to address the crisis. And I can tell you, they understand the problem. They definitely understand the problem from talking to them, to the heads of these commissions and key people doing the research. Now, whether they'll do much about it and make the sort of recommendations that I think the evidence leads you to, well, that's probably not going to happen, at least not in the near term, for political reasons, because they're scared to death of being called, of this sort of the attacks I just said, wanting to create Pravda or Izvestia and you know, have kick Glenn Beck off the air, and that's their mission in life, which might not be a bad mission. Hi, Glenn. It's going to be difficult because of that, but this is just the near term. And let me talk a little bit about sort of where I think we could go, what sort of solutions in the near term we could look at, and where I think we're going to have to go in the next few years if we're going to solve it. First of all, let's dramatically increase the money to public and community radio and television. And I emphasize community there because I think a lot of people say, oh, I really don't like PBS. I'm really tired of their mainstream news. I really don't like NPR. I don't like their mainstream news. The first stations that go under when that funding goes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting are all the community stations in the country. Those are the first ones that go down. WGBH is the last one that goes. The community and college stations are the first ones that go. That understand that immediately. So that is a war we have to fight. That is a war we can't afford to lose. We should be spending, you know, instantly $5 or $10 billion. So we have competing newsrooms, public, community, college stations in every town, independently run, covering their communities because no one else is covering them. Secondly, and I talk to a lot of students, this is probably the worst labor market to be a young person wanting to be a journalist in American history. I think it would have been easier in 1932 to graduate from an American college with a journalism degree and get a job in a newsroom than it is today. I'm dead serious. In fact, I'm positive it would have been easier in 1932. It's hopeless today, and there's such downward pressure in wages, and the work you end up doing is basically PR spin junk. It's not journalism. It's a dreadful situation, and it's something we can't tolerate. One thing we have to do, let's take 10,000 kids out of college and give them a 1 or 2 year stipend, like we have Teach for America, make it Right for America. Assign them the newsrooms all over the country. Get them working. Get them covering this community. Assign them the community stations. Get people doing journalism. We can't lose a generation. All the research shows that when people do journalism, they respect it, and they respect freedom and democracy a lot more. And people stop doing it, they don't really appreciate it anywhere as much. We can't lose a generation. And I can tell you right now, there are thousands of people. I talk to them all the time. In fact, I just came from Ohio University. Young people desperate to do journalism who really want to do it. And it's frightening to think they won't even be able to get a minimum wage job doing it, let alone a job that they could pay their bills. We can't allow that. I want to close instead on 2 points. I've been personally very disappointed in the current administration in the United States. But I think the point I would make here, why this is so important, is that what's happened with the current administration is they have accepted the Republican framing of the economy, which is basically the economy's in bad shape because we have a deficit. So if we get rid of the deficit or lessen the deficit, the economy will grow. And that's a type of economics that comes from Herbert Hoover. It comes from the Great Depression. It comes from Secretary of Treasury Andrew Mellon. And that was basically lower taxes on rich people, slash all social services, balance your budget, and the economy will magically grow. It's preposterous economics. That's an aside. The reason I mention all this is that President Obama and his administration, regrettably, have bought into that. And they've accepted that logic as the defining logic. So there can be no new expenditures unless you can pay for them, unless it's a war. And of course, that's another matter. But anything else that's good, you can't add it to the payroll, to the budget, unless you can pay for it. Otherwise, it's off limits, even though that would be very good for the economy, probably. But that's another matter. So Nichols and I said, well, okay, what are we going to do then if we can't add new programs like Right for America or More Money for Public Broadcasting? What could we do with the current spending in our budget to address the journalism crisis? And there are two places we go right away and make a huge dent in it with current spending. The federal government today spends roughly $4 billion a year on public relations through all its bodies, and a lot of that's in the Pentagon. $4 billion. You know, why don't we take half of that and give it devoted to journalism? Maybe there's some good use for public relations. They have to do some stuff. But a lot of that's just PR people spinning journalists so they have a favorable treatment of some government program or agency. Now, that's offensive in the first place. But it's especially offensive when we have an army of PR agents spinning no journalists left to spin. What a joke. Why don't we just give the money to journalists and cover the thing and get rid of the PR agents? Right there, we could come up with 10,000 reporters that we could get working around the country. Secondly, another place we could go with currently being spent money, most Americans aren't aware of this, but we spend roughly twice as much money on Voice of America and overseas broadcasting than we do on NPR and PBS. We spend $750 million a year on Voice of America and overseas broadcasting. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was just in the Washington at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee testifying about this 2 or 3 weeks ago, and she acknowledged that it's a complete failure, that our radio message, especially in the Middle East, isn't working. It comes across, our commercial stations come across as just junky with advertising, like CNN International. And our Voice of America publicly subsidized stations come across as clumsy propaganda that's not telling the truth, and that Al Jazeera in the region totally blows us out of the water. She said that. Hillary Clinton. So we need much more money to do the job, and we've got to change our strategy. Well, I agree, but let's say we can't get the money for now, but we can change the strategy. Currently, it's illegal for Voice of America to be broadcast in the United States. That's the condition of its existence. We aren't allowed to hear that propaganda, apparently, or that journalism. This is not off limits. What I recommend we do is take most of that money, not all of it, keep some for translations. What isn't used for translations, take the rest, and give it all to public and community stations in the U.S., and all the money has to go exclusively to international coverage. And then what we'll do is we'll take the results of that and we'll air it around the world. We won't have the double standard. The same journalism we get will air to the Middle East and to Africa and Asia, and they can hear what we're getting too. Right there, that's $500 million right there, and then that buys you a lot of journalists. That gets you more foreign coverage than we've ever had in our history. Now, when we finished our revised edition, we were depressed. We were saying, okay, well, politics, this is in January. This is hopeless now. The Obama administration is not doing anything really to speak of. They've pretty much sold us out. It doesn't look good in Washington. The last election was bad. It looks like we're playing defense. It seems like we're getting nowhere. And it seemed like our argument when we started drafting the new version of the book was, well, we're going to have to go back to the streets. We're going to have to get demonstrations. We're going to have to raise hell. And then we looked at each other and said, well, what are the chances of that? And that conversation took place literally the day before all hell broke loose in Madison, Wisconsin. And we were both in Madison. We lived there. And I must say, even if you've watched sympathetic media, and there's been some sympathetic media, Amy Goodman and Democracy Now!, Ed Schultz has done some sympathetic stuff, Cenk Uygur, Rachel Maddow, that's about it. Even if you watched that, you have no idea what took place in Madison and what an extraordinary, life-changing experience that has been for everyone who was involved in it. It reminds you, first and foremost, why one of the five core freedoms in the First Amendment is the right to assemble. And another one of the five core freedoms in the First Amendment is the right to peaceably address your grievances to the government. Because the power that comes from 150,000 people together, united, they're simply not, the words have not been put into our language yet to convey it. You have to experience it. And people in power understand that. That's why that's in our First Amendment. And if you were there in Madison and if you saw large chunks of this, of the people demonstrating every single day, at least 10 or 15,000 people just coming down, and on weekends, 50, 100, 150,000, you could see large chunks of the people assembled, and you'd say, well, this looks like what we're told by the media is a Tea Party rally. Working class white people. They're supposed to be really reactionary. I was there every day. I was in the crowd. I wasn't a leader. I was just one of the people there. I didn't see a single racist thing. I didn't see a single immigrant bashing thing. By the end of it, the last 2 weeks, the chants were tax the rich, stop the wars. It was sort of like being in France in 1789, the vibe. It got more radical every day. And the spirit, the nonviolence, the compassion, the humanity of the protesters, again, it was life-changing. And I mention this now because if we're going to change the sort of stuff I'm talking about, journalism, which is a revolution, it really is. If we got what I just talked about, that's a revolution in this country. It's not going to come in the abstract. It's not going to come in isolation. Everything else in this country stays the same. We have the same horse manure health system, the same crappy tax system, the same unemployment, the same inequality, the same garbage can environmental policies. It's not like those things will all stay the same, and plus we get this world-class media system. Of course, who's kidding who? It doesn't work that way. They're all together. We win them all or we win nothing. We organize together on all or we lose everything. It's basic politics. Saul Alinsky put it well. The only way you beat organized money is with organized people. That's the oldest rule of politics. It's as true today as back in 9,000 BC when they planted the first seed in the Tigris and Euphrates. And we can win, but we've got to do some serious organizing. And part of it is we've got to change our media, because the media coverage that took place in Madison was appalling. But it did do one great thing of great value for the people of Wisconsin who were participating, who would then go home and watch the news or pick up the paper, go online and check the coverage. They got a first-class, world-class education and bad journalism, and how important it is to have good journalism. And now they're media reformers. Because you get involved in politics, you learn pretty quickly you have to be a media reformer if you want to win your cause. And that was the lesson we got there. Thank you very much.
That was Robert McChesney, The Future of Journalism and Democracy. He spoke at the Arlington Street Church in Boston. Robert McChesney is a leading expert on the media. He's the author of numerous books, including Rich Media, Poor Democracy, and co-author with John Nichols of The Death and Life of American Journalism. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado, celebrating 25 years on the air. Since we began broadcasting in 1986, we've always offered AR-free to all public and community radio stations in the United States and the rest of the world. AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. That's why we can do programs such as the one you just heard, and others featuring such voices as Bill Moyers, Helen Caldicott, Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, Arundhati Roy, and Tariq Ali. To access our complete audio archive, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of Robert McChesney, The Future of Journalism and Democracy, just call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Martin Folco recorded the program. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Stephanie Brown is our editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.